So who we got you? Alex Clark. Clarky, welcome. Riley, Shane, Pricey.
Thanks.
Anthony Shield. All righty, Tony, we'll give it about another 30 more seconds and then we'll get into this.
No worries.
You're one of my interns. Jack's back. Did you lecture Jack Walton? Tony, do you remember the name?
Well, I don't know, possibly. There's a lot of them.
There's a lot of Jacks.
a lot of students. Yeah. Yeah. I remember Mr. Price.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shane, Pierre. Last Wednesday, so Wednesday night, we've got two dogs, a male and a female, and the male impregnated the female. So we had pups last Wednesday. First set of puppies.
Joy. How many?
Tony, there were seven. To me, totally fascinating process. So we try to do a bit of research. Everyone told us how difficult it was, how bad it would be. So the first pup comes out and I'm cutting the sac and disconnecting the umbilical cord and all this kind of stuff. And then I said to my wife, I said, I kind of felt like our Pixie's the female. I kind of feel like she had it. So each time I did less and less. Nature was amazing. It's a stupid interventionist. I don't know, whatever. By the end, she knew what to do. She ripped open the sac. She ate the placenta or the afterbirth, whatever you call it. And then disconnected the umbilical cord and just like that, you know. And Vince Kelly then. Ooh, pressure's on.
Ooh.
Pressure's on.
So I'm expecting some friendly fire.
All right. I reckon we'll give it a crack. We'll give it a start. We're 2 minutes in, 2 minutes over time. I'll keep letting people come in as they need to. Just as a reminder, everyone, can you please turn your mics off or on to mute? There's the chat option. So if you've got any questions for Tony, and I've had a few from social media, Tony, we might get onto those. If anyone does have a question or wants to pick something up that Tony's talking about at that current moment, just flick through the chat option. As always, if you use the private, if you message me privately, I won't mention your name. And if you talk to everyone, then I will mention your name and Tony can address you that way. Coming up next, we've got Damien Marsh, Queensland Reds, was with the Brumbies, won a premiership with the Brumbies, the Reds, back to Brumbies and back to Reds now. And if you're interested in specific sports, so we've got Brant Best and Stefan Widmar in swimming. We've had Andy Friend in rugby union, and we've also had Ben Cross from rugby league. That was specific coaching stuff there. Anthony Shield, welcome to our chat.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Now, Tony, there's a lot of stuff that we want to cover on here, but just for a starting point, can you tell us a little bit about before you became known as Tony Shield Hamstring Group? Like, I'm especially interested in coaching. I know you've done strength and conditioning. I think you even competed in powerlifting. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I started as a human movement student back in 1986. And so in some way or other, I have been for 35 years now. And my fascination was with how muscles adapt. And initially it was, how do I make these things big? Mm-hmm. And that started when I was 10 and didn't have any big muscles. And over time it's evolved to, how do I make them strong? How do I help people throw far? How do we run faster? And very recently, how do we prevent injury? And so I was an aspiring but ordinary athlete. I threw a javelin mainly. And for a javelin thrower, I was a good weightlifter. And for a weightlifter, I was a good thrower. So within that little subset, I was pretty good. Like a lot of us, my interests evolved because my talent didn't. I started off coaching predominantly in the fitness industry. So I met a lot of bodybuilders back in the late 80s here in Brisbane who wanted to know a little bit more about getting big. And for most of them, it was a matter of training a bit less, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I got involved in some GPS coaching just after I finished my PhD, some Queensland Academy of Sport coaching as well. I was there for a very, very short period of time. In fact, I think I took over from Vince for about 3 months after Vince left to go to the Auckland Blues.
So when you say coaching, is that S&T coaching or sports specific?
Okay, so it's just strength coaching. It's not even strength and conditioning, because way back in the 80s, some of us were just strength coaches.
Yep.
And so I'm a bit of a dinosaur in that sense. The conditioning aspect of this industry has evolved a lot since the mid-80s. I find myself now doing a bit of coaching, but predominantly just for one athlete in track and field, and that's just a family connection, which is a nice thing to be doing. So I'm still doing some coaching, but my coaching has never been at the super elite level. I've enjoyed, nevertheless, the coaching I've done and the GPS stuff. I was at Churchy for quite some time, but about 18 months, in 2000.
So just for the international listeners, when you say GPS, you mean high school, high school athletes, private school athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was my most enjoyable coaching I've ever done, because I had an 18-month stint working with a squad mostly of rowers. And we could, as a consequence, have, and I was also given, I was trusted to make the decisions as to where we went with that program. Whereas sometimes at other places, you're really under the direction of a coach who insisted that you did X, Y, and Z, which, mm-hmm. you know, I always found stifling. And at the end of that, well, that was at the end of my PhD, and then when my academic career started in 2003, I've been more of an academic since then.
Okay. What took you into academia?
Initially, didn't know what to do when I left school. So went to uni, got a fair way through my uni degree. I saw my academic mentors living a life that I didn't fully understand, but I thought was pretty good, because I was at the University of Queensland. Mm-hmm. And my lecturers would disappear at lunchtime and go for a swim across the road or a bike ride around the uni. I thought, oh, this looks all right. I fell in love with the University of Queensland's campus as well. So I thought, yeah, an academic job doesn't sound too bad. And it's been the job that I most prefer to whinge about out of all the other options.
Gotcha. All right, cool. All right. So 2003, what happens there? When you say academia, what does that mean?
Yep. So I got my first full-time job as an academic at RMIT in Melbourne. So RMIT had a very small exercise science program, and it was exercise science and physical education, as a lot of the programs have been in the past. So I found myself in Melbourne for 6 years teaching into that program. It was a very, very teaching intensive job. There was limited opportunity for research, but it did bring me back to a place where Aussie rules football was important. And that started me thinking about injury prevention. And eventually my interest in making muscles adapt became melded with trying to prevent injury. And it's predominantly as a consequence of reading David Morgan's work. David Morgan was a researcher at Monash University who'd done a little bit of work on eccentric exercise and how he theorized it might protect us against injury. And that's really where I started with a growing interest, embryonic interest in hamstring injury research around about 2007, 2008.
Okay. So in that early stage, when you're looking at injury prevention, like, and it's an interesting thing that you say that, because while you're talking about going from getting big to getting strong, yep. that process is fairly common, isn't it? Like, a young coach, and especially in Australia where we work with the football codes, where you work with a 15-year-old kid and the coach has said, this kid needs to put 5 kgs on in the off season. So it's a fairly typical process, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think it starts with it started with a really superficial fascination of what made muscular people the way they were. Yeah. How on earth would I replicate that or replicate that for other people? And eventually you start to think a little bit more detail. Of course, when you work in sport or with any athlete, it's not how they look, it's how they perform. And so you do eventually evolve, even if you have this, you know, fascination with the very visual adaptations that you can stimulate. And of course, they're amongst the easiest ones to stimulate for a coach.
Now, with regards to the hamstrings, at the early stages, was it like, let me pick the hamstrings and go this direction? Or I'm in Melbourne, AFL, kicking sport, sprinting sport, this is a dominant thing, and it actually might be useful to solve this as a problem?
Yeah, I was always fascinated, again, with the, you know, causing adaptation within muscle. And I all my thinking had been around quadricep-related performance paradigms. And then David Morgan's work came along, where he proposed that developing a resistance to muscle damage through eccentric exercise would reduce injury rates. So we had a little bit of a link with the Carlton Football Club just in my final year in 2008, being in Melbourne, and we started to do some work with them. And not much of it ended up being published, but it ended up stimulating some ideas. And I started to think more from an injury prevention perspective, and realised, because I got into injury prevention by mistake or by accident, and then realised, oh, this is the sort of thing that is of interest to journals, for example. So it suddenly became easy to publish, and it was interesting to sport. And if you know, hamstring injury being so prominent, it was interesting to lots and lots of different sporting clubs around the world. So it led to invitations. So I really stumbled upon it. Seemed like a reasonably good direction to go.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about those early days? What were you discovering that might have been a bit groundbreaking at that time, or maybe just solidifying current paradigms?
Okay. So as I mentioned before, it was really stimulated by David Morgan's work at Monash. And just coincidentally for us, David was pretty much close to retirement in the early 2000s. So I think he might have retired in about 2005, and he had a couple of publications which were quite significant in 2001 and 2004, and then it stopped. And so my interest in his work suggested, well, we should take this further. So, for example, he was the first one that I knew who suggested that eccentric exercise might lengthen the fascicles within a muscle, and that lengthening of fascicles might render them less likely to become ruptured, less likely to strain. And so some of the work that me and colleagues of mine have done since was what I felt he might have done if he'd had longer to go in his career. But it's also fair to say that he was an engineer, and he may not have gotten into the sports medicine quite so heavily as we have. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's hard to tell exactly where he might have gone. But yeah, that was the motivation for us.
Okay. And then, so with this sort of change in mindset from yourself and change in paradigms and looking at injury prevention over pure performance, what is the connection from there to, well, now we have the Nord board and all that kind of stuff, but the popularization of the Nordic hamstring exercise?
Yeah. So David Morgan had a paper, and I forget whether it was a 2001 or 2004 paper, but he used the Nordic exercise to cause muscle damage. Mm-hmm. And he had a group of individuals do something like 70-odd Nordics. I think it was, 12 sets of six Nordics.
One session.
Yeah, one single session. Okay. So he destroyed them.
Yep.
And he looked at the torque joint angle relationship and how it changed across the next 2 weeks.
And from the one some session. Of those,
most of the individuals did one session, and then some of them repeated that workout 1 week later. So they followed them for 2 weeks, but two sessions. Yeah. And there was a shift in the torque joint angle relationship, which is something that's not always been replicated. But that to me suggested that, because it fitted with his mechanistic description of how we might prevent injury, I thought it was worthy of further investigation. And then in 2007, a study came out, was a non-randomized trial looking at Nordics and stretching in Nordic Scandinavian football. Mm-hmm. And it was from a guy called Arne Arneson. And I remember teaching my undergrad students about this study. And the first thing, it was the first time I'd really seen the Nordic used as an injury preventer. We'd previously seen it used to just cause damage, mm-hmm. Muscle soreness. And the first thing I thought when I saw a picture of it was that exercise sucks.
Okay.
Because there's no feedback. There's no feedback about performance.
Okay, there's no measurement. There's no way to quantify week to week. Yep.
Yes. So I like the buy-in that numbers produce.
Yes.
Now, sometimes they can produce a buy-in that you don't really need. So some of you might have heard on the news today, Majak Dor ruptured a pec sometime in the last couple of days doing bench press. So there's a North Melbourne Aussie Rules football player possibly going to miss maybe the whole season off the back of trying to get a better bench press, which of course is a bit of a crazy injury to have for a footballer, but there's numbers involved. That means there's ego involved, and that brings about buy-in from my perspective. And remember, I started out as a struggling weightlifter, powerlifter, for whom numbers were everything. Mm-hmm. And the Nordic exercise didn't have any numbers associated. You know, someone was holding the ankles in these early images of the exercise. So in my honours work many years, well, some years earlier, you know, back in the 80s, I'd use load cells, and we use load cells to measure isometric strength. Mm-hmm. It's a very old-fashioned thing to do. We've moved on from isometric measures to dynamic measures much more now. But the exercise lent itself to isometric measures because you could simply strap load cells to the ankles. Someone could then do a dynamic exercise and you could still get some feedback. So really the concept of the Nord board was about just trying to provide feedback. If indeed people were going to do this exercise, I thought it'd be more fun if we could quantify it, boast to our mates about it, and perhaps get better buy-in.
Okay. So, you were in a unique position based on your honours, AFL, hamstrings, Morgan, to make those connections and put them together.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right. So then the Nord board the Nordic comes out. From my side, you know, I like the Nord board, whatever. That's a separate thing. I'm more interested in sort of getting down to the bottom of perception and what's reality and what the research is showing and all that kind of stuff. So that's a bit of a background. You now start to build up your group of hamstring researchers. Tell us a little bit about how that happens, because I'm a non-academic.
Yeah. I was in a really fortunate position where I had a lot of really gifted undergrad students roughly at this same time. So I moved from Melbourne to Brisbane and started at Queensland University of Tech, which is where I am now, QUT. And one of my very, very bright undergrads from RMIT came up to do his PhD with me. That's David Opar. Mm-hmm. And in my first year of teaching here at QUT, I ran into a couple of really good undergrad students. So one's Matty Bourne, mm-hmm. who's now academic at Griffith, Ryan Timmons, who's mm-hmm. now an academic at ACU and at working with Dave Opar's group. So I had a very, very bright group. And at QUT, I also had some time to actually do some research. Mm-hmm. And I built the first Nord board in 2010 with the help of a technician. And so we had a device which in, I think, the summer of 2010, 2011, we started to mess around with. We got some vacation research students to be involved. I think we had four of them. And we really just essentially tested this device to see what it could and couldn't do over the summer. And from then, Dave Opar became more involved. We tried through the university then to commercialize the idea. And what people have to recognize is that the initial concept was simply to give feedback to people whilst they do the exercise. Mm-hmm. And that's the number one claim that I'll make about the Nord board. I think it makes, my own personal view, it makes Nordics less boring.
Yep.
And after that, though, to commercialize something at a university they didn't like the idea that my claim was it makes Nordics less boring. They wanted something more to come of it. And as a consequence, the risk factor studies started to evolve. So we needed to prove to the university that this was a measurement that might have some role in helping a team manage their injury risk. And as a consequence, Dave Opar led that first AFL prospective injury study.
Mm-hmm. And that was pretty interesting because there started to be a real change in the landscape, and there was also a massive groundswell of all this, the stuff coming through. Now, if we had to take, you've got, as you mentioned, Bourne and you've mentioned Timmins and all these other guys, what are some of the things they deviated from the Nordic, some of them, and went to, what are some of the lessons that these guys started to learn about the hamstrings that ties into your goal to prevent injuries?
Yeah, well, I suppose if I can just beat my own drum briefly, almost all of my PhD graduates have come from undergrad courses that I've taught. Mm-hmm. And so quite, you know, it's a really pleasing thing to see someone as an undergrad and to take them through to the point where they've done a PhD and they've walked into academia. So also, I never wanted to produce too many PhDs because I don't want them to be PhDs that don't have a job that, you know, a PhD is useful for. So far, I've had 5 PhDs finish and they've all got academic work pretty quickly after they've left, after they've graduated.
Awesome.
But one thing that's really important about their characteristics is that they're bright and they're hardworking and really, really hardworking. Mm-hmm. But they got an opportunity, I think, because we were the basic understanding of how muscles work and how muscles adapt, which they learned from me and from others like Vince, for example, in their undergrad courses, was something that they could continue with in the injury prevention area as a postgrad. So I suppose then we just created a nice environment, and then those guys created an environment that attracted others as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you have good postgrads, it begets more good postgrads who want to come along and be a part of a group. And so it's increasingly difficult to do that because now at universities, it's harder and harder to encourage people to go through to become a postgrad. And of course, not everyone wants to work in hamstrings, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. But that was the start of it.
Okay. Now, just on that, with this strong group who had a massive presence, how do you guys prevent or minimize forming an echo chamber amongst yourselves?
Yeah, I think that there's always an appearance from outside a research group that, or a perspective, an impression that inside this research group, they all believe in X plus Y equals Z, and that's all that they believe in. And, you know, I've never found that to be true of the people that I've worked with. And there's quite a lot within the group that we don't always agree about.
Can you give us an example that might be relevant in this case? Like, hey, Matt Bourne, his research is kind of taking that way. I disagree or something. And I don't think people are more interested in the ideas.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll give you an idea of where we can sometimes get unstuck with exercise science and injury prevention. If you imagine, what are the outcome measures in research that really, really matter in sport? Well, one is performance, but it's wins and losses. It's not how fast you can run 10 meters. Mm-hmm. The real performance measure that matters is wins and losses. And then secondly, I would argue how much injury you have to sustain, because the less injury you have, again, it influences performance. So it all comes back to wins and losses, really. Mm-hmm. But too often in exercise science, we can't measure those things, or we feel we can't measure them. So we measure something else. We measure some surrogate.
Yeah.
So for example, we have done most of the work to suggest that fascicle length in the hamstrings is a risk factor for injury. And that came about as a consequence of Ryan Timmins' PhD study, where he got 8/10 of the A-League involved, measured their strength, measured their fascicle lengths pre-season, and followed them for injury. And if your fascicles were less than 10 and a half centimeters long, you were four times more likely to sustain an injury. Now, that has led to a number of training studies that measure fascicle length as an outcome measure. So the caution that I would suggest that we need to have is that fascicle length itself is not one of the outcome measures that we really care about. Mm-hmm. No one sits on the sideline saying, yeah, that guy's got great fascicles. You know, he either gets to the ball first or he doesn't. But we nevertheless do research now with fascicle length as an outcome measure. So, for example, and this is work from my colleagues at ACU, and they'll understand that I'm not having a go at them in any way. But when we use, when we find out, for example, low volume Nordics with high intensity, low volume Nordics, we can get fascicle length changes. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't prove we get injury prevention.
Sure. Yep.
It is a surrogate measure. As a consequence, it's it's worth doing. The study's worth doing. The study is interesting. The study might hopefully inform an intervention which aims at measuring injury prevention in the future, because it would be great if we could get an injury prevention program that doesn't take very long. But it's a surrogate measure. So I'm not going to change my practices overnight based on these sorts of acute studies or very short-term studies which look at how we can change fascicle length, because fascicle length starting to deviate away from the really important outcome measures.
Gotcha. Now, just while we're talking fascicle length, what can, I'm in the private sector. I don't have a big budget. There's a lot of people listening here, schools, strength and conditioning coaches, interns. How do we give our athletes the best chance of based on specifically the fascicle length, how do we give our athletes the best chance of minimizing injury with our current knowledge now?
Yeah. I think in the absence of being able to measure some of these things, and again, it's not that fascicle length is not the most important outcome measure. Nordboard strength is not the most important outcome measure. But ultimately, we know the methods that have led to those changes in the past. And ultimately, just to look at your levels of evidence and think about the systematic reviews and the randomized controlled trials that have actually reduced injury. And then if you go further down in the levels of evidence, well, you've got to think to yourself, is this consistent with what's happened here? Mm-hmm. So I don't think it matters that we can't measure fascicle length. As I've said before, it may be that fascicle length actually doesn't matter, because along the way, it may just simply be the damage resistance of muscle. So the outcome measure one outcome measure we could all look at is, how sore do our athletes get?
Yep.
Are the athletes pulling up sore every time they do RDLs? You know, do they limp for 3 days after doing that workout? Or if I do 3 Nordics, do they get massively sore after that? And if they do, I would suggest they don't have great damage resistance. So there's a lot of very simple measures that all of us can do.
Okay, so I'm thinking aloud here just as a practitioner. So I want to be targeting whatever, you know, and you've got a sport like tennis where you're training 2 sessions a day, 5 hours on court. But I want to be gradually still targeting a bit of DOMS at the end of my hamstring work, whatever that is, however it fits into my current training. But right the way through their career, is there an end point or what happens?
Yeah, I think in those circumstances, then it's tempting to say that we do have some low dose eccentric training programs that have been investigated. Mm-hmm. They do result in some of the adaptations that the higher volume workouts cause. We still have to be cautious about whether that proves that there's an injury prevention effect. But from my interpretation of how this works is that damage resistance is a really important part of it. So if we can get athletes to harden up, get them to the point where it's very, very hard to make them sore, then we're in a good position from a perspective of muscle strain injury.
Yep.
And if I sort of think about all the athletes that I've dealt with over the years, when I was initially dealing mainly with bodybuilders, powerlifters and weightlifters, their predominant complaint was, I can't get sore anymore.
Yep.
No matter what they did, they couldn't get sore. And then, in contrast to that, in football codes, the predominant complaint when you're talking about doing some eccentric exercise is the guys get too sore.
Yeah.
And so there's this different ends of that spectrum. And I can't imagine, to be honest, being at either end. But it's very easy to make some athletes sore. And I think the more running that they do, the less we want to bomb them in the gym. So we've got to find a balance somehow. But maybe in the future we'll have some work which shows that running-induced adaptations can be beneficial, and then we don't have to get them off their legs into the gym. Maybe we can employ more of a running-based protocol, which I think is going to keep a lot of coaches and athletes fairly happy.
Yep. Yeah, that makes sense. That fits in together. Now, you are tightly, rightly or wrongly, you are tightly associated with the Nordic exercise.
Yep.
And then, you know, we learn about these categories of hip extension and knee flexion, and we talk proximal and distal and all this kind of stuff, which to me, Tony, I look at some of the stuff and I think some of it's useful for categorization.
Yep.
But then I use the example of food groups. We've nominated what these food groups are, and based on whatever, then dieticians tell us you need to have all your food groups, but it's our imposition of this. It's our intervention on it. Tell me a little bit about that. That's a criticism of the Nordic. Do you think it makes that much of a difference, or is it just let's get eccentric cause that DOMS?
Unfortunately, at the moment, we just don't have enough hard evidence. And so if I wear an academic cap, I can't say with certainty that other interventions will work equally well. But with a coaching hat on, I can't see why there's any need for any one particular exercise to be, the core of a program. So our group has done, and we continue to do, quite a lot of work looking at hip extension exercises and comparing them, looking for what's common and what's different when we do those as opposed to Nordics, for example, or leg curl. We're finding that the sorts of adaptations overlap quite a lot. Mm-hmm. There will be in the future, I think, some really interesting opportunities to explore the longitudinal effects of interventions that are based predominantly around knee flexion tasks in the gym versus hip extension tasks in the gym. Recognizing, of course, that most athletes, are powerfully extending their hip and flexing their hips as they run. And so it's movement around the hip that's probably far more sensible to concentrate on from a performance enhancing perspective. Mm-hmm. But one area of research that I'm quite interested in, and we're going to be exploring this with Matty Bourne and some colleagues of his at Griffith. We've just recently got some QAS money, and amongst the things we'd like to look at is the proximal aponeurosis to bicep femoris long head muscle thickness ratio, because this aponeurosis is very big in some people and rather small in others. So it varies a lot between people.
Wait, can you just say that again? So the ratio between the long
head... So the aponeurosis, that thin bed of connective tissue that comes from the proximal tendons. Obviously, the proximal end of the bicep femoris muscle comes from the aponeurosis.
Yep.
So you've got this aponeurosis. It's typically, I don't mean to give you all the finger, but it's typically rather thin. And obviously muscle size varies quite a lot between people, but also this aponeurosis cross-section or surface area influence varies quite a lot between people as well. Mm-hmm. And some biomechanical modeling by Hansfield and colleagues suggests that it's likely to increase muscle strain when we have a very big muscle and a very small aponeurosis.
Okay. And at the moment, is that... Can we influence that?
Well, that's what we would like to look at. I mean, we've seen some research on the aponeuroses for the quadricep muscles, mm-hmm. and we can change it, but it doesn't change fast. It's like everything. If you look at how quickly muscle adapts compared to the connective tissue around it, and the muscle adapts so much faster. So one thing that we could do is we could get this ratio going in the wrong direction if we cause too much hypertrophy of the bicep femoris long head.
Yep.
And it's highly likely in the first 6 to 10 weeks of training that we're going to get more muscle hypertrophy than aponeurosis changes.
Ooh, this is going to be interesting then.
Yeah, so with regard to the knee-oriented exercises, they don't recruit bicep femoris very powerfully at all. They tend to rely heavily on the semitendinosus and the short head of bicep femoris. So a Nordic, for example, but also a leg curl, won't cause a lot of bicep fem long head hypertrophy.
Yep.
Now, that actually means it leaves the aponeurosis to muscle width ratio in a good state.
Yeah.
If we instead do hip extension exercises, then we know that they're much more effective at causing hypertrophy. And they're effective at causing hypertrophy across all of the long heads of the hamstring. So they're good for bicep fem long head. They're good for semitendinosus. They're good for semimembranosus. And that sounds like a good thing. And I reckon there's a 50% chance that it is a good thing. But I think there's also a little bit of risk in that we may get some significant hypertrophy of bicep fem long head. And initially it might leave the aponeurosis behind. And if that's the case, we might be causing ourselves greater risk. But this is all very hypothetical at the moment. It needs lots of testing. It's probably going to take 3 to 5 years before we'll have a really good, solid opinion on that. But it's part of the theoretical base for what we're doing.
That's fascinating. And again, Tony, I'm coming from a coach's perspective, and I'm interested in how it can help my athletes. So if I'm working with, club level players or youth athletes, there seems to be a building momentum for, low equipment facilities to introduce and make sure that the Nordics are included at some level to as just part of an overall program.
Yeah, and I'm always really careful about how much I bang on about the Nordics, but it's hard to, from a research perspective, to imagine why you wouldn't have them in there as a part of the whole. Mm-hmm. It's just that I don't think they have to be the whole, of course. Yep. A lot of athletes around the world have been in lockdown for a little period. If you're lucky like me, you've got a gym in the garage. If you're not so lucky, what do you have? You've got very, very little to work with. But you could do Nordics. Yep. You could find a way of restraining your ankles. So, from a coaching perspective, it's not much challenge to prescribe. And I think a lot of coaches want something that's more challenging to prescribe. They probably want to feel like they can use their coaching abilities to take someone through, for example, a one-legged Romanian or a Romanian where you lift with two legs and lower with one. All of those things take a little bit more coaching. For all we know, they're equally effective, but they're harder to do in the sense that you need some equipment and the buy-in. In round ball football in particular, the buy-in, as soon as you leave the pitch and you walk off the grass, the buy-in to different parts of training is so limited in certain club cultures. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think very, very few people understand. I've been fortunate enough to visit quite a number of EPL and Bundesliga clubs, French clubs, many of whom have played Champions League football. And there's great arguments about the high injury rates in Champions League football. And people suggesting that, they all do Nordics. So if Nordics work, how come you have such a high injury rate? But when I visited Bayern Munich in 2016, they did no strength training at all. Mm-hmm. So there can be no conclusion made on the basis of, in my view, Champions League outcomes. Chelsea, I visited them in 2013. They did no strength training at all until you got injured. And then they used it as part of rehab.
Gotcha.
So there's some very, very big names in round ball football, and their strength culture didn't exist.
Which is fascinating because it has such a high reputation, isn't it? If you're one of the guys associated with some of those clubs, you can kind of pick and choose where you go from there. That's interesting. So Tony, just getting back to it. So you've talked about some internal, paradigm disagreements that might be the case, you know, within the so-called hamstring group, whatever that is. What are some of the things that, you know, when on social media, when I read it, what are some of the valid criticisms of where the research is now? The things I always see is someone presents a study and they go, well, that wasn't elite. And you go, well, yeah, it's impossible to do, induced DOMS that are going to stop people from walking for the next 96 hours because no team is going to let you do that. So what are some of the valid criticisms of your guys' research?
Yeah, so that's the best one. Of course, all of our intervention studies start off with recreational athletes. Now, as we can try as hard as we like, we've got maybe 30 people in a study and perhaps five of them you admire as well-conditioned athletes, and a lot of the rest of them are not. That's always going to be a valid criticism, except when you think about it from the perspective of, you know, Bayern Munich do no strength training at all, so I guarantee you all of our 30 end up a bucket load stronger than, the Bayern Munich squad. It doesn't mean they have skill. It doesn't mean they're ever going to earn any money as athletes. But that's one of the criticisms. My own perspective is influenced largely by the lack of reproducibility of some of our own work. So, for example, we've done, or me and colleagues of mine collectively have done around five prospective injury risk studies in which Nordboard score or strength is a measurement. And the first one was in AFL, and strength was a risk factor. Mm-hmm. Weaker guys got hurt more. The next one was in rugby. So this is Matty Bourne's part of his PhD in rugby. Mm-hmm. And you gave him some help with that, I think. Yep. But he didn't find any relationship between strength and injury risk.
Did you find a relationship between strength, injury, and position? Would that have been a bigger factor? Like, I'm thinking the AFL guys would be a more homogenous group.
Yeah, and that may be a confounding factor. We didn't find anything there. There was nothing trending at all. There was a imbalance between legs, which seemed to have a role in injury in that study. Ryan Timmons had the third of those prospective studies, and he found that strength was a factor again. Then I'm trying to think exactly which one came next. We gave a Nordboard to the Aspetar group in Doha. Mm-hmm. So Rod Whiteley, Rail Barr, and in the end, Nicol van Dijk did a PhD doing a number of things, including this, at a large-scale prospective study in the Qatar Stars League, round ball football, and there was no relationship at all between strength and outcome. And so at this stage, it's four studies in, you're batting 50% of your studies suggest that it's a factor and 50% suggest that it's not. And it's knowing that and then seeing other people quote selectively which ones of your studies they want. Mm-hmm. So they'll say, there's no relationship, we'll quote the rugby and the Qatari study. There is a relationship, we'll quote the AFL study, which is just the first study, and then Dave Opar's group with Josh Ruddy looked at AFL injury risk again 2 years later after our first study, and the guys had all gotten a lot stronger and strength was no longer a risk factor. So even within the AFL, you're batting 50% mm-hmm. for outcomes. So the measurement on its own, in terms of your injury risk, I don't care so much about it. I just generally think it's a good idea to be stronger at something because it helps you to get buy-in.
Yep.
And then it reflects a little bit your damage resistance. If you've done heaps of eccentric exercise, you're probably pretty hard to damage.
Yep.
And that's where it rests with me at the moment. So when someone says to me, what sort of cutoff do you want on the Nordboard? A lot of people will look for the cutoffs from those studies. And recognizing that three out of the five studies, there is no cutoff because there's no protective effect of being stronger. Mm-hmm. But in two of the five, we've got certain cutoffs, and a lot of teams, as a consequence, want to get their players to hit the cutoff mm-hmm. every time. And then if they get above the cutoff, they think their athletes are safe. And it's just, that's not what the cutoff is there for.
Yep.
The cutoff is a statistical thing to tell you that your relative risk is this much higher if you're above or below the cutoff.
Yep.
And it's not a target for athletes. And that's one of the big issues with when novices approach, if you're not a researcher, but you're reading research and you're doing it because you want a take-home message,
yep.
Unfortunately, you tend to look at results and you interpret what your take-home message might be, whereas a researcher looking at the same research will look at the methods and sometimes they'll stop there because the methods suck and there's not much point going further. But even if the methods are solid, they've still got limitations. So you'll look at the methods, then go to results, and then you'll think to yourself, is this going to influence my practice at all?
Yep.
And it depends a lot then on what the outcome measure is. Is it a really important outcome measure or not?
So. Gotcha. Now, we're just going to quick change of pace here. We've got a question come through privately.
Yep.
Tony, is a running-based protocol something you or your colleagues are currently working on?
In terms of trying to prevent injury?
I'd be guessing it'd be an eccentric injury prevention, sprint-based.
Yeah. So first of all, as most people know in this area, we have not led by any means the running sprint-oriented prevention side of things. There's other groups around the world who are doing that. But we do have an interest in it. So I have a PhD student, Rudy Klemer, who's from Belgium. And he really wanted to investigate the role of kinematics or running technique and injury outcomes. Unfortunately for Rudy, the pandemic that's keeping us at home at the moment and preventing us from being face-to-face with real people in laboratories is going to get in the way for the moment. And his work is now taking a different tack, hopefully just temporarily, where we're going to explore, whilst we can't do face-to-face research with real people, we're basically doing some online survey-related research where we're talking to coaches, and these are coaches from the world of track and field, but also strength and conditioning. We're talking to them about what they think about the role of technique in injury prevention and how they might, what is optimum technique? How do they like to change technique if they think it's suboptimal? And the idea behind that is to try and look at coach-led research when eventually we get out the other side of this.
Mm-hmm.
So whilst we haven't published anything in it yet, we're actively working at it. And I wish we'd made more progress before the world got shut down on us, but that's where we're at.
Okay. Now, just want to... so that's the one question. Then I've got another question with regards to coming back to that Nordic. What I see a lot of variations on social media. In fact, some of the most popular posts on Instagram and stuff are these weird variations, people doing some awesome stuff. Can you just clarify what your thoughts are on this, you know, based on what the research says and I don't know, whatever's out there?
If you're commencing with a group of completely untrained people who have no injury, then you have to just look back and what do the randomized control and even the non-randomized control trials tell us? They didn't use modified Nordics at all. They just did normal Nordics.
Mm-hmm.
And suppose my take-home message from this is that don't be a control freak about exercise technique. Don't try to say to yourself, these guys have no control. So for example, you start off a Nordic here, mm-hmm. you get to here, and suddenly you're flat on your face.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people suggest that's a deficit in technique. We have to do better. And then suddenly someone's got a rubber band around their chest so that they can lower themselves with more control over a greater range of motion. So for all I know, that might be optimal. But the original research studies never used it. And that would suggest to me that the normal conventional Nordic does a job. And by the way, we very, very quickly in our training studies, and we've done a couple of these now, we get people to have very, very good control within 2 or 3 weeks. And we have to put 10 kilograms on their chest or 5 kilograms on their chest so that we can pull them down a bit faster. So if your athletes just continually get 30 degrees in and fall straight away, they're not trying. And that might be partly because they're not getting any feedback about their performance. You know, we can tell people, you just got 200 newtons on your Nordic, and when my daughter was 12, she could beat you. Well, straight away, you get 300. So that's numbers help in that sense.
Yep.
But when people use some sort of assistance exercise, might most often be after injury, and that I can quite readily understand. I personally find that you don't need a lot of equipment for it, though. So I recently tried to race my 15-year-old daughter over 70 metres for me, 80 metres for her, and I won, right? We did 5 reps, and my very last rep, I've got a very minor hamstring strain as a consequence. So I still won the last one, but now I've got a little niggle. It's a very minor injury, and what I do what I call Nordic push-ups. So I get my ankles restrained. I just do push-ups, but I try to use my hamstrings to control the eccentric part of that push-up. Mm-hmm. I don't need any fancy equipment. I don't need a rubber band. I have used a rubber band in the past, by the way. I've advised others to use it after injury. I've used it myself after various injuries that I've had. And it can be useful to start off with less load than body weight, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the capacity to regress something is there. There's a range of different ways you can do it. I just think that you should think carefully about what is in the intervention studies that have led to reduced injury rates. And if they didn't regress the exercise below body weight, maybe we don't need to for healthy people.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. I'm just wearing my coach hat there. That's, how to balance all that information, but I'll definitely take it on board. So then, Tony, we at our gym, we've got a glute ham raise. People seem to confuse the two. I'm not convinced they're as similar as, well, I've got my own thoughts there. What are your thoughts?
We've used a glute ham raise as part of Matty Bourne's muscle activation study, where he looked at 10 different exercises. And our interest really was lateral to medial hamstring activation ratio, mm-hmm. because the other interesting thing about the various hamstring exercises that we do is that according to EMG, it looks like the medial hamstrings dominate during a knee flexion task, like a Nordic, and that the lateral hamstrings become a bit more active when we do a hip extension movement. And the more work we do on that, it's a bit more complicated. But we really still do see some differences between knee-based and hip-based exercises, where with the hip-based exercises, we get fairly even activation of all of the long heads of the hammy. So semi-tens, easy to activate in anything you do for hamstrings. Semi-mems, quite hard to activate. And we're learning that a Romanian deadlift or a stiff leg deadlift is a really good alternative for that. But any of the hip extension movements activate those medial muscles with bicep fem long head quite evenly. So there is a capacity then to target different parts of the hamstrings. And if, for example, you've got some bicep fem long head atrophy, then hip extension movements are a better stimulus for muscle growth than your knee-based movement. If you've got a semitendinosus problem specifically, then you're very fortunate, because every exercise we've ever looked at really hits the semitendinosus quite hard. If you've lost your semitendinosus to ACL reconstruction, then you probably want your medial knee rotators to be strong again eventually, and your semimembranosus is left behind to do a fair portion of that work. And semimembranosus works well with stiff leg deadlift or Romanian deadlift. So I probably deviated a bit from the origin of your question, but there's some of the things that we actually do know with reasonable certainty now on the back of the work that we have done.
Yep. I think that's very useful stuff to do, especially from a rehab perspective. And then, Tony, with all these exercises, you said in about 2 to 3 weeks, we should be, aiming to have a 5 or 10 kg plate for the Nordic? Is that fairly consistent? Or is,
yeah,
is,
well, It's what we've done in all of our intervention studies. Now, whether or not, now go back again to the randomized controlled trials that have tried to reduce injury, they didn't use this, but they ended up doing three sessions a week in the off season with around about 30 repetitions per workout. And then in season, typically it was a single session per week, but maintaining again with 30 reps. So that's the way that's been shown to prevent injury, at least in high-level amateur and low-level professional footballers, round ball football. So whether that works in a different sport, whether you're better off with extra load, I'm not sure. But we certainly use the extra load to stimulate adaptation because we figure that that is, you know, part of the principle of resistance training, of course.
Yeah.
And so with all those longitudinal studies where the outcome measures typically a strength and or fascicle length, then there seems to be some advantage to putting the extra loads on people's chests.
Okay. And Tony, in terms of myths out there, anything that you want to crush that you think is gaining too much traction, or and where I'm coming from on this is, yep. I think I like to think that a good strength and conditioning coach will have, I don't know, whatever the numbers are, let's say 85% of their program is just solid, basic science. It's backed, whatever. There's about 10% where you think, hey, you know what? I'm covering my bases. And then maybe 5% where you have a bit of freedom there just in case. Yeah. Any myths there that you feel are disproportionately gaining traction that might actually be harmful in some respect?
Okay. I'll choose my words as carefully as I can because I think there's a really big chance of getting misinterpreted when asked that question. So here's my hopefully cautious answer.
Okay.
We've got a lot of sexy hypotheses. And a sexy hypothesis is more readily acceptable for a big proportion of our industry than a daggy data set. So to give you one example, this is not me trying to criticize the alternative, but at the moment we have large scale RCTs and systematic reviews which tell us that eccentric hamstring work reduces injury rates. But we have an alternative approach which doesn't always have to be used in isolation, but isometric hamstring conditioning is the alternative that's being proposed. And it's being proposed by multiple different groups. I'm not trying to suggest it's any one group or one promoter of this, but right at the moment, there is not a single intervention study with isometric oriented training to look at injury outcomes. Mm-hmm. And a couple of studies looking at different outcomes, like how long you can sustain hip extension for, like hip extension strength endurance. But no one has ever bitten off the really difficult project. The difficult project is an intervention study with 600 plus athletes, where you have 300 of them at random do an intervention and 300 do something else, whether it's control intervention or a standard treatment. So in my view, hypotheses get more traction than they deserve, even if they're correct.
Okay.
And so I'm not against any form of strength training. I think all strength training is pretty good. I wouldn't want to train hamstrings concentrically only, but fortunately it's pretty much impossible. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want a program that just had isometric or pseudo-isometric exercises at the expense of the eccentric. But as someone who does a little bit of coaching, I'm perfectly happy to see eccentric and isometric tasks melded together. And as you say, ultimately probably 80% of the program should be just good, sensible conditioning of athletes, with the predominant thought in mind of, if you prepare your athlete well for the sport, so if you prepare them specifically enough for their sport, chances are their injury rates will go down.
Yeah.
So if predominantly they run fast, chasing each other or chasing a ball, that's got to be part of training if you make them fit, you give them the capacity to keep running fast all the way through the game without getting too exhausted, without their technique in running falling apart or losing a lot of strength, because that's one other important area for future research, then you'll probably be pushing in the right direction most of the time. And then with that 20%, as you said, you've got some decisions to make. You're going to have a predominantly eccentric approach or an eccentric isometric approach. I don't really mind what people have, but I just think be really careful about what's hypothesis as opposed to data.
Yep. Oh, that makes sense. I definitely think from a coaching perspective, if you take those three categories of solid science, hey, some pretty good directional, and this is a little bit of a, just a Hail Mary. The issue comes in when they slide down a level. So when you've got your Hail Marys as, as not so solid, and you're not solid is what your program is based on.
I agree. I think that I always say to my students, there's an evidence base if you're lucky, but we all know that there's a limit to the evidence base. It can probably tell us a tenth of what we need to know to condition athletes at any high level. Then we've got a first principles approach, which is our understanding of exercise science. You know, how can we come up with something that's specific to an athlete's requirements in their sport? And part of that is conventional practice. You know, what is the conventional practice in track and field or in round ball football or in any sport that you work in? That conventional practice is there for a reason. Even if it's got a lot of stuff in it that's questionable, it's what everyone else is doing. So that's probably where you should start. Mm-hmm. Train the way that other athletes do in that sport. And then, of course, you've got coaches who will tweak a little bit at the ends to try and get something extra out of it. And over time, the coach will become convinced it's important to continue with, or convinced that it didn't work and change something. So that's how we evolve, I think, over time. We try to implement new ideas, and some of them stand the test of time and others don't.
100%. So, Tony, then just looking back, reflecting on your career so far, and I'm sure you've still got a number of years to go, 10, 15 years ago, what were some of the beliefs that you had that you now think are wrong, or a direction you're taking which maybe you're not as convinced on?
Yeah, so prior to, this is one of the missing link from the explanation before of how I got into some injury prevention work. I took the view that eccentric exercise might lengthen fascicles and as a consequence have a significant impact on the force-velocity relationship. I won't go into detail into the mechanisms, but ultimately power output at high velocity concentric actions is really important in a lot of sports. Mm-hmm. So if I'm throwing a shot put, it's how fast I release the shot put that dictates how far it goes. And I felt that eccentric training becoming a bigger part of the strength and conditioning program could have positive effects on muscle architecture and therefore positive effects on the performance outcome. And I spent some time trying to get funding to explore that idea, and I got no funding for it at all. And the same physiology, though, was proposed at the time, again, by David Morgan and his colleagues to prevent injury. And preventing injury turned out to be a much more fruitful endeavor for us from a research perspective. So I used to have this idea that the eccentric conditioning was going to really change performance. And whilst I still think it may help tweak performance, I have gone from thinking I can make this much difference, I suppose. I've started to think more often I can make this much difference.
Yep.
And maybe the difference we can make is roughly measurement error. So a lot of people say, well, you're failing in your hamstring injury research because the AFL still get lots of hammy strains. The EPL still have it as their number one injury. But I think we could actually be succeeding in an almost subliminal way over time. And that's what I think might be a realistic outcome. We can make almost a difference that's almost not able to be discerned. And that's a bit sad if you spend a lot of your life on it, but I think that's a fairly realistic outcome.
Do you worry that, you know, we talk about strength being neuromuscular, and much of our conversation now and the stuff that I've seen is very, you know, architecture, fascicle, yep. It's very muscular. Yep. Who's doing good research on the neural component of this? Or is there anyone?
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
I think Matty Bourne's doing something, isn't he? No.
Yeah, well, like he may be, but the predominant work that we've done looking at the concept of neuromuscular inhibition being a problem in rehab. Mm-hmm. We know that when someone does an ACL or any sort of traumatic injury to a joint, they lose a lot of strength around the joint very, very quickly. It's not caused by atrophy after 2 days of injury. It's yep. caused by inhibition.
Yep.
And then, you know, some injuries require surgical repair, but years later, there's still inhibition. Mm-hmm. And there's often atrophy as well. And this may be where Bourne fits in, because Matty Bourne, I think it's 2017 or 2018 paper, has an image of an elite long jumper. A guy that's an 8-meter-plus long jumper, which is pretty special. Mm-hmm. And he had a 4-year-old bicep femoris long head injury, and his bicep fem long head on that side is very, very small by comparison with the same muscle on the opposite side. So here's a guy who's jumping 8 meters-plus in long jump and still has marked atrophy, which we presume is the result of his 4-year-old injury. And we have worked on this concept of neuromuscular inhibition for some time, but we were slower at doing it because the PhD student responsible is a guy called Rob Bowman. And Rob is now at Sunshine Coast University, but he's recently finished his PhD and very recently published his first study, which is looking at voluntary activation of the quadriceps with of the hamstrings with twitch interpolation. And he's got a group of people with moderate to severe hamstring injury. And some of them are 2 years on from return to sport. Some of them are more like 3 months on from return to sport. But on average, they've been back for 9 or 10 months. And they still have marked neuromuscular inhibition, which is only evident during an eccentric contraction. Mm-hmm. So the rest of his work has been looking at where in the nervous system do these deficits live? Mm-hmm. And thus far, he's found some evidence for deficits in reflex function. So stretch reflexes are dampened yep. in people with a prior injury. Now, that might tell us a little bit about how to recondition that athlete, how to rehabilitate them. And then he's also got some transcranial magnetic stimulation where we've stimulated people with a magnet through the skull. And he has some evidence of some inhibition in the motor cortex as well as a consequence of these injuries. So there's a target potentially for rehab through here yep. and a target which is more peripheral. Now, the answer to this might simply be serious strength training, because we know every one of us in the strength and conditioning field knows the nervous system contributes enormously to strength gain. And we've actually, my group and I have developed a theory that neuromuscular inhibition caused by the initial injury leads to deficits in strength, which expose you to further risk of injury because it changes muscle architecture, but also from a nervous system perspective that it could contribute as well. And it may be that you even become more fatigable as a consequence of these neural adaptations. So sometimes in rehab, we get people and their strength recovers nicely, but their drop off in strength with repeat sprinting is terrible. They drop off enormously rapidly, and we've really got to learn more about that and try to prevent it. But the next step for Rob, because we'll continue to work on this and for other PhD students in our stable at QUT, is to explore this better in higher, more elite athletes, because most of our folk are recreational level athletes and their rehabs wouldn't have been perfect. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have been very intense. So we want to ask the question now, is this neuromuscular inhibition equally evident in the very, very highly trained? And I suspect that in some of them it is, because, for example, we have that long jumper with atrophied bicep femoris long head, and we know this athlete's history with strength training. He's done a lot of hamstring work in the 4 years since that injury, and he still hasn't caused he hasn't got the muscle anywhere near close to the same circumference or cross section as the other leg.
Wow. 4 years later. I think, yeah. Matt Jordan, I think, is another name that comes to mind in terms of the neuromuscular deficiencies there. Now, team, we're going to take mics off mute. If you want to ask Tony a question, just let me know via the chat, and I will turn your mics off mute and you can ask him a question directly. Tony, last question for me.
Yep.
Common question. What would you tell a young Tony Shield?
Yeah, good guy. Yeah, okay. Oh, pull your head in, young man. One thing that I've tried to learn, I suppose, over time is just to be comfortable with less certainty. And you and I have talked about this as the basis for this conversation today. Rather than thinking, okay, I'm going to read some research, I'm going to take a take-home message. My take-home message is to do 30 Nordics a week for all my athletes. I tend to think more in terms of, on the basis of all the things that I've read, what mistakes would I most prefer to make? Because I'll probably always make mistakes. So one example of this is you could be working with two athletes. One is 15 and one is 25. And the question is, how much volume are you going to prescribe in their training? And what's the mistake you'd rather make with a 15-year-old? For me personally, is to do a little too little, rather than too much.
Yep.
At 25, you'd have to know the context of the 25-year-old, but at 25, I might think differently. Mm-hmm. If they're 25 and they haven't yet reached the pinnacle of their sport, which you think they can, maybe you might try just a little too much or a little more than you would otherwise think, but it's the mistake you'd prefer to make. And that's one way of thinking a little about what we see in research. And I suppose one other thing that I would tell myself is that you're simply not going to cause as much change in people's minds as maybe you think you're very influential and good with words and good at arguing. And ultimately, it only has a certain amount of influence on people. There's a heap of people you can't convince, or a lot of people you can only half convince. And it's no great detriment to your achievement in life.
Yeah, I think Taleb says, what other people think is none of our business.
Yeah.
I'm embracing that. All right, team. If you've got any questions, I'm going to just change my view here so we can see who's coming off. Pierre, Jack, Shane, Vince, Corey, if anyone wants to ask a question, feel free to take your mics off mute. We'll give it a couple of seconds. I've still got like 1,000 questions to ask you, but what have we got there?
Everyone's very shy today.
All right. We've got Pierre who said no mic today, but you've asked the question I was going to. Thank you, Pierre. There's a bunch of stuff. Sorry, is that someone got? There's a bunch of stuff that I was going to ask you about just quickly as a one last thing, if no one else is going to ask this question. But Tony, any differences that we need to apply male to female athletes?
Yeah. We've done almost no work on female athletes from the perspective of hamstring injury. And that'll sound terrible, but it's based on the prevalence of injury in men and women. And when you have data from the same sport, so we sort of by chance got access to a data set from a guy called John Dresner. And John had done a study over 5 years at the Penn State Relay meet in the United States. So it's a track and field meet, and most of the events are relays. Anything from, 4x100, they probably got 4x800s, but we were interested in the sprint events. And the Penn State Relays involves masters athletes, open age athletes, high school athletes. So you've got men and women at three different age bands competing, and several years worth of data put together. And I think we had something like We've had many thousands of athletes. There might have been, you know, 48,000 athletes who competed across these 3 to 5 years. We just selected 3 years worth of that data and just trolled through it to look at injury rates. And they're much higher in men than they were in women. They're a little bit higher in older men than they were in younger men. That just tells you exactly what we knew already. But it takes sampling from the same sport. Now, when we look at women's AFL, for example, it seems that they're so busy rupturing their ACLs, there's not a lot of time to do hamstring damage. And so our work in female, in injuries that has more impact on women's sport is the ACL-related work, which you've done a little bit of as well, because we believe that hamstring function after ACL reconstruction is obviously in deficit, typically because of the surgical procedure. And we've wanted to try and explore that a little bit more. But yeah, we've done almost nothing in relation to women and hamstring injury. Mm-hmm. We've measured a bunch of athletes, men and women, in terms of how strong they are. We've got some idea then of what athletes in certain sports can achieve. So we see the sprinters and jumpers getting really exceptional Nord board strength, for example, especially when you consider they're very, very light body weights. But yeah, we just don't know enough, unfortunately.
Okay, that's no worries. Pierre just asked, did that study, I think he's talking about the Penn State relay, did that study include severity as well as occurrence?
No, because in these single event sports, basically you're just looking at how many people come through the medical tent complaining of an injury on that day or on those days. And so there's no, as far as I'm aware anyway, there's and John, by the way, is a big, big data set. And the way that that originated was that we'd seen the abstract published and we'd never seen the study come out. So we got in touch with John and said, this is an amazing data set. We'd like to see it published. And he's, how come it's not? He said, oh, well, he's become, his career took a different path. He's a cardiologist now, a really leading guy in that field. And I suppose if you're interested in hearts, hamstrings lose their significance.
Yeah.
But he may well have some information about severity, but it's not part of what we publish.
Okay. Awesome. Tony Shield, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated. As per usual,
a lot
of things to follow up. I really like that that quote you said, what mistake would I prefer to make? I think that's a good mindset to have because, I mean, moving forward, that's what's going to happen. And you just kind of think, do I want to err on this side or on that side?
And I think unless you're prepared to make one, you get paralyzed. So, you know, I remember the programs I used to write for myself when I was a first year uni student. And it was all about how would I get big and strong? Yeah. I'd write the program and then sit there and look at it and think, oh, it's crap. And I'd rewrite it. And I spent more time writing programs than in the gym.
Yeah. We see that a lot with young coaches who spend so much time. And then as you progress, anyway, that's for another discussion. Tony, thank you again for your time. You've got to rush off.
Thank you.
Everyone, thank you. We'll see you with Damien Marsh, head of high performance with the Queensland Reds. Chat to you later.
Cheers, guys. Take care.
Bye.